about to start with our meeting, but we are waiting for the presentation. The, what do you call it? No, the presentation that we are going to get today, we do not have copies of it. So somebody has gone to photocopy it. We don't want to start without the members seeing what is written on those copies. That is why I am sort of lingering around and not starting the meeting. Members, do you allow me to do that? Or I am taking just an irrational decision on my own? Are you allowing me to do that?
Jay, you've got that liberty, but you might want to at some stage deal with the other preliminary issues. Yeah.
That presentation has 34 pages. It's going to take some time for us to learn. But anyway, let me for now open the meeting officially and welcome everybody in the meeting. Today, honorable members, apologies. Let me start with the apologies. After. We don't have any written apologies. We have verbal apologies, which I am not going to present here because they are verbal. Members, we are going to get a presentation from ESCOM that will be led a few minutes by the evidence leader, and then from there we will let ESCOM present the pension fund, ESCOM pension fund and provident fund. But before we do that, we would want the members. I'm not sure. Are you all from the pension fund? Firstly, all of you who are seated here. There is no one who is not supposed to be here who is here. Okay, very good. Before the we have two presenters of the pension fund issue, and we are going to ask them to take an oath or an affirmation. I'm not sure they are going to take an oath. They agreed to take an oath. So before we start, we will first read to them the oath, and then they will sign the papers in front of them. Do we have that? Honorable Mazon?
Chair, if I may make a suggestion, and I don't mean to usurp your leadership as chair, but Chair, while we're waiting for the presentation and before we do the oath, because I think it's only right that we do the oath once we start the presentation, could we perhaps deal with the issue of the letters of what I would term blatant intimidation that this committee has received, and how we're going to be dealing with it?
Honourable members, that's the suggestion.
I support it, Chair.
Okay. Honourable members, fellow South Africans, we have received a letter from the Black First Land First Movement. It is addressed to me, the committee secretariat, and Honorable Baleka Mbete. I don't want to read the letter. Do you allow me to read the letter as it is? No. Yeah, I don't want to read the letter. But the content of the letter is asking the committee to stop the inquiry. As of yesterday at 13 hours, that is 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon, if not, we will be taken to court. It is like that. I will allow the members to speak on the letter because this letter is intimidating us not to work, not to go forward. It has names of people that they have mentioned in this letter. And also, they are saying the current inquiry by the committee, the nature of the current inquiry by the committee is not clear. Honorable members Mazone, Honorable Luyenge, and Honorable Swart and Honorable Shivambo.
Chair, firstly, you know, I hate to even give a letter of this ludicrous nature oxygen, but one must. Chair, the allegations within the letter are both legally unsubstantiated as well as completely flawed. There is a lack of understanding of the Constitution as well as lack of understanding of what the fundamental duties of a Member of Parliament in terms of our oversight obligation are. Chairperson, I note the line that says that if we do not stop this committee by 1300 of yesterday, that legal proceedings shall be instituted against the committee. Chair, my response to that is bring it on. I don't scare easily. This is not a committee that scares easily. We have an obligation to our country, and certainly not Black First, Land First movement is going to stop us, nor anyone else. Very, very poor and failed attempt at intimidation, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, having received this letter, I want to first point out that as this committee, we are an extension of Parliament, and we have an obligation to listen to whoever wants to share information which is to the best interest of the public. And we have processes, we have mechanisms that are used in execution of that duty, which I believe, having gone through the contents of this letter, that the writers of the letter have more information, broader information on state capture. But unfortunately now we are dealing with ESCOM and we are dealing with particular and certain individuals. If they have that kind of information, they must liaise that with proper channels, and we won't ignore what they seem to be part of what we were doing. So this part of work that we are doing now, it can't be stopped just because they have further information, including other individuals that we might not be aware of. They must submit that information and ask us to do the same to those individuals, but not for us to actually derail our focus and consider what they say. They must follow the right channels to give us that information, and they will be called to come and say what they want at an appropriate time. Ngosla.
Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Honorable Swart. I'm afraid that when Honorable Luyenge said they will be called, if you remember the stance the very same people have done in the Committee of Finance here inside Parliament, I hope you've got a protection on me, that you have, you'll protect me.
No, thank you, Chair. We as a committee will decide who we call, and we will not allow anyone to intimidate us. We are resolute, as you've heard, across political party lines. We are determined to get to the bottom of the rot. And if this group the headline of this letter, Stop Witch Hunt of the Guptas and Let the Judicial Commission of Inquiry on State Capture Run Its Course. We have a constitutional obligation. This is an oversight inquiry, and it is very important that we will not be intimidated. If there is any legal ground, I don't see any legal ground, let them go to court and let them try anything. But as I say, we will not be intimidated. And an addendum to this is we also have information that one of our witnesses has received life threats, death threats. Any death threat against a witness here or this committee is a death threat against Parliament, and it is threatening our parliamentary sovereignty. So we take it very seriously, and we would say, stop trying to intimidate this committee, stop trying to intimidate our witnesses. No weapon that is formed against us shall prosper. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Shivam.
No, thank you, Chair. I really don't know why we're entertaining the Gupta militia. I mean, like, this BLF nonsense is a militia of the Guptas that seeks to divert honest work that is being done by Parliament. They tried to do that when we were busy with the corruption of Tutumieni and the misgovernance of SAA. They came to literally disrupt the Standing Committee on Finance. And what I said when we got a letter from the Minister of Public Enterprises, Lynn Brown, is that the content, the prose, the packaging of the letter sounds like BLF. And here it's confirmed now that the same issues that are raised by the Minister of Public Enterprises are raised by BLF. It looks like these state captured people, like the captured, the beneficiaries of state capture, are working from a central office. They are coordinated somewhere to try to resist the honest, necessary work that we're doing to end state capture. I think we must dismiss this thing. I think we must respond with one sentence letter to say we're not going to do what they're asking us to do, and it's finished. And then they can go to court. We'll respond them to court. I don't think that there's any rational court in South Africa which will say we can't conduct our constitutional obligation of overseeing the executive. We have to oversee the executive. It's a constitutional obligation which we must never neglect because of some rascals who are hired by a corrupt family. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I did not get your prompt response in saying, should I respond to the letter or not? Yes.
Chairperson, it will only be professional and human to acknowledge a receipt and respond that unfortunately the contents of this letter does not make you feel that you have to do what is contained in the letter.
Chair, it's important to respond because if there is any legal action that is brought, this letter will form part of the annexure, so it's important to deal with the issues that are raised in the letter. And I would refer to our legal department as well to advise as a correct response, but it's clearly a letter of trying to intimidate us, but it does need a response. Thank you, Chair.
I already said, Chair, that we must respond with one sentence that says that the committee has seen your letter and we're not going to do what they're asking us to do. And you've got a right to go to court if you feel like the court is an option. And then we'll meet them in court, and then they're going to lose the cost with costs, and then we'll chase them to look for the money which they have wasted our time on. So let them bring it on.
Thank you, honorable members. And I think that we have disposed of the matter now. Can we then go to the main agenda issue of the day?
and that is the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund. I will therefore read the oath to them, and you will respond. Because you said you are
sorry,
taking
Chair,
an oath.
I'm just not sure. It's a very large delegation. Are they all going to take the oath, or how? Because, and maybe we can get an explanation why there's such a large delegation. I presume each one has got some role to play. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart. The two presenters will take the oath. Whatever the presenters are saying, we take it that they, all of them, are within they are going to listen to what I'm going to read to them. They will fall in the same category, but the two presenters will sign the oath and will take the oath. Thank you very much. Do you want to say something?
The soldiers so that they must take individual oaths. Yeah, I just wanted to make that point.
Okay. I will start with Maisele, you will be the first one to take the oath, eh?
Okay. Yes,
you can switch off the network. Okay, in accordance with Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily to all questions lawfully put to you or produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a house or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17, Subsection 2 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who fully vanishes a House committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period of not exceeding 2 years. You are required to take an oath or affirm that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. You may choose to take the oath or the affirmation. Which do you prefer?
I prefer the oath.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing else but the truth. So help me God. You'll raise your right hand and say, I solemn you, so help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you very much, ma'am. You've got the document in front of you. You'll sign it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. The same with Mr. Luthuli. It will be the same with you. You have listened to the content of the oath. Therefore, you are saying, I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you very much, and sign the document of the oath in front of you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, the oath has been taken by the two presenters, which I think they understand the content of the oath that they have taken. I will now give over to the evidence leader to take us through.
Just want to start by giving a broad question so that allow you to do your detailed presentation. I think I've read your presentation. It's quite a detailed presentation. I would give you an opportunity to present it, and later on I'll come and ask specific questions. But you're here to assist the committee to understand the governance at ESCOM. Of course, you're not at ESCOM, but you're a pension fund, of which ESCOM is a contributing employer. We specifically would like to understand the circumstances that led to your involvement in the payment of a pension amount to one gentleman called Mr. Brian Molina. If you can take us through the governance structure of the EPPF, the relevant rules in that process, and everything that you know, everything that you participated in during that process. Over to you.
Before the EPPF response, I just want to take the committee back to the to the 23rd of May. Remember, in our resolution on the 23rd of May, we raised a concern on the 30 million rands that was going to be paid by ESCOM or by the pension fund to Mr. Molefe. Then we said we would want to know how did they come to the conclusion that he needs to be paid 30 million. We need to take we need to take that into consideration and see how do you calculate a person who has worked for 18 months and be paid 30 million for his contribution in the entity. So that we also claim ours in Parliament. We went more than 18 months. Thank you. Thank you.
No, I'm not going to. I wanted to ask that maybe before their presentation, they introduce the people that they came with, and then so that we know who is that side there.
Thank you very much. You'll do that. You'll introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Mantuka Maisela. I'm the chairperson of the fund. I'm an independent member of the fund. And next to me is Mr. Lutuli, who's the chief executive and principal officer of the fund. Behind me is Michelle Davids. She's our legal advisor. And the senior counsel, Mr. Maineji. And over there, it's Lebohang Mohashwa, who is our legal advisor within the fund. And next to him is Mr. Sanka, who is responsible for the operations. And behind him is Mr. Vitali, who is the benefit manager, who administers the actual benefits. And next to him is Ben Stein. Ben Stein is a board member who is representing the pensioners at ESCOM. He was previously head of operations within the fund. And then Mashadi, she's also a legal, part of the legal team. And Mr. Lutuli is the CE and principal officer.
Have you introduced only eight, or have you introduced all nine of your members? Because they are nine.
Yeah, I've introduced everybody. I've introduced everybody. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. You can then take over and present.
I think
can I proceed? Okay, thank you, honorable members. I think it's important that I start by giving a background about the fund itself, and then I'll proceed to describing how the fund works and operates, both from a governance point of view. I'll also then go specific to the issue pertaining to the circumstances surrounding the onboarding of Mr. Molefe. Then I'll proceed to talk about what happened when he was a member. I'll then talk about what happened and how he was exited at the fund. I will then talk about circumstances that arose after he had been exited at the fund and was retired and became a pensioner of the fund. Starting with the fund itself, I think the name of the fund, as it has been indicated, it's the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund. Generally, people refer to the fund as EPPF. So as I talk, when I refer to the fund, if I say EPPF, I'm still referring to the fund. It's a short acronym for the fund. So the fund is a defined benefit that is registered in terms of the Pension Funds Act. I think it's important that I just explain a little bit that you can have a defined benefit or you can have a defined contribution fund. These two funds work in very different ways. In a defined contribution fund, what happens is that members contribute on a monthly basis, and when a member either exits the fund or retires from the fund, there is a benefit that is calculated based on the contributions themselves, plus whatever market returns those contributions would attract. So the risk rests with the member in that type of a fund. In a defined benefit fund, when a member has contributed, when they exit the fund, there is a formula that is used to calculate the benefits of that member. So in a way, the member is shielded from the market fluctuations when they exit. The fund has to then assume the market risk that when they exit a member, if the markets are down, they still have to pay a particular benefit that is calculated via a specific formula. I think it's important that we just note and park that description, because when I explain the circumstances surrounding how the 30.1 million was calculated, those principles would then have to be factored in. The fund has got its rules. These rules are registered by the FSB, and these rules serve as the foundation of the fund. So the fund can't operate outside the rules. It has to operate within the rules. The fund is governed by a board of trustees. It's got a board of 14 trustees. Out of the 14 trustees, 7 are appointed by Eskom as the participating employer. 7 are elected via an election process. Of the 7 that are elected, they represent various constituencies. 2 of the 7 represent pensioners, so they are elected amongst the pensioner pool. 3 represent trade unions. There are 3 recognized trade unions within Eskom. It's Solidarity, NUM, and NUMSA. So each of those trade unions then again go through an election process where they then elect members that would represent them. Then 2 are elected from the general member population who are not, bargaining unit members. They also go through an election. The term of office of the board is 4 years. So each board sits for 4 years, and after 4 years, we then have to run an election process. This election process is run independently by the fund, which then results in those that get the highest number of votes either being re-elected or new members coming in. No board member can serve for more than 2 terms. So it limits that after the second term, you then have to step off the board. So currently there is a board that is in place. the board that is in place came into effect on the 1st of June 2016. Whilst the board exercises control and governance over the fund, it's however not practical that the board can attend to day-to-day activities. So the board has then, the fund has a management team, which then attends to these day-to-day activities in terms of running and managing the fund and executing on board resolutions and board decisions and board mandates. The management team is led by myself as the chief executive of the fund, as well as the principal officer of the fund. I then have an exco that assists me in terms of the day-to-day running of the fund. The fund operates, the board has got, there's a governance framework in the fund whereby the board has delegated powers to myself as the chief executive, and there's further delegation to other management within the fund to make sure that from day to day there is a smooth running of the fund. So this is done through the governance framework. There are also specific delegations that the board would have, which would be relevant in terms of the application of the rules. The fund is a restricted fund in the sense that its membership is restricted to eligible members only, and also the participation as well, there's limitation that not everyone can participate. People that can participate in the fund are those that are employed by Eskom strictly, those that are employed by also Eskom subsidiaries. The one subsidiary that I can note is Eskom Rotech Industries. Members of Eskom Rotech Industries are also members of the fund, as well as the fund itself employs employees. It's got employees, and these employees are also members of the fund. So in the main, in the fund, there is three participating employers, the major one being Eskom and Eskom subsidiary and the fund itself. To be able, even if you are employed in one of these entities, there is an eligibility criteria in the rules of the fund that has to be applied such that you can then become a member. Part of the eligibility criteria requires that a member should not be more than 65 years old. So if the employer decides to employ someone who's above 65, then they cannot be part of the fund. They are not eligible. And also, as indicated, that you must be employed by one of the participating employers. And then you must also not be on a fixed-term contract or employed for fixed-term purposes. So you must be permanently employed in terms for you to qualify as a member of the fund. Again, I think that point, I want to re-emphasize it, because later on, when we do speak specifically about the Molefe issue, we need to then come back to that point and deal with issues of eligibility. Just to give a sense in terms of the membership of the fund has about 85,000 members. Of the 85,000 members, roughly about 46,900 of those members are active contributing members that contribute on a monthly basis. So that would be, those would be members that are employed by each of the various employers that I've mentioned before. The fund is self-administered. What that means is that we do everything in-house. We do not outsource the administration of these members. So we collect contributions every month. We then manage the members that we have. We also pay out pensioners. Of the balance of the 85,000 being 46,900 being active members is then pensioners. It will be pensioners, it will be beneficiaries, and it will be what we call deferred members or deferred pensioners. Deferred pensioners are people that have been working for an employer, and when they leave the employer, they decide to leave their benefits with the fund such that the fund can manage their benefits up until the time that they get to retirement age. The fund also has got assets. Currently, the fund has got in excess of 143 billion rands in assets that the fund manages. Again, even in the management of the assets, we apply what we call a hybrid model. What I mean by hybrid model is that some of the assets are managed by the fund itself. It's got its own investment management unit with its own investment management team that manages various asset classes. then some of the assets we then offer or we allocate to external asset managers where we do not have the requisite skills to be able to manage those assets. I think it's important that I also highlight that as a fund, we operate on a good faith relationship with the employer. This good faith relationship with the employer is quite crucial and very important, because without this good faith relationship, it will become very difficult for the fund to be able to verify certain information. For example, in the instance of members that are joining the fund does not have access to documents for a member that joins the fund. We never get to see an employment contract. We never get to see the terms and conditions under which the member has been appointed by the employer. We do not know whether the member is temporal or a permanent employee. So we rely on a relationship of trust with the employer, and we've gone through a process where we've defined what it is that we expect from the employer. We've gone through a process where the employer knows and understands the rules. I'll come back to the issue of that. And it's important to also articulate that when members come into the fund, there are no separate forms that those members complete, because membership, as I alluded earlier on, is compulsory. So members, if they are permanently employed, they are compelled to become members. So there's a process which I will then allude to where on a monthly basis, there is exchange of information between the fund and ESCOM particularly, where we then get relevant information that will help us to be able to then process. So what happens on a monthly basis is that the fund receives certain information electronically from the employer. I'll particularly speak about ESCOM, but understand that we've put in ESCOM RoadTech in there as well. The same process will apply. So we receive files on a monthly basis. Generally, it's three files that we receive. There is one file which we call a LEC file. I think the terminology should not concern you a bit. I'll explain what it means. Then we receive another file called the pay file, and the third file that we receive is what we call a res file. It's important to just differentiate between these files. They all come together electronically, but what the LEC file contains, it actually contains information that has got membership data. So that is where we would pick up that there are new members from that file. And we have gone through lens to agree with ESCOM in terms of what information should be on that file, how would we identify whether a member is permanent or not permanent. We went through an extensive exercise, I think around about 2012. The fund migrated into new systems. And following that, ESCOM used to send us documents that had people that did not qualify to be members, where the codes were people that were temporal employees. And this caused huge problems for us in terms of having reconciling items. So we then had, there's a lot of exchange that happened between the fund and ESCOM to agree that these are the people that, in terms of the rules, qualify as members. These are the people that, this is the information that we expect on the file. And there was agreement subsequent to that, and we then started getting information that is information that is useful to the fund. I did mention that there was a pay file. The pay file is the file that contains payment information. So for each member, member A, this is how much contribution that is being paid for that particular member. Again, this is driven by the rules that there's what is called a pensionable salary, and your contribution must then be based on the pensionable salary. There's a formula that is used whereby the employee contributes 7.3% and the employer contributes 13.5%. So we then do a calculation to test that what we are getting as a contribution ties back to what the member earns as categorized as a pensionable salary. Then we get a third file. This third file is called the res file. What really the res file contains is information of all members that are exiting the fund for that month. So when we get these files, the fund goes through various tests to make sure the LEC file, we test it, it gets uploaded, then we get a list of all new members because those members would not have existed in the prior month. So the system generates a list of these are the new members. Then there's someone that would go and check that actually these members, the codes actually says that this is a permanent member. They will check that the information, there's an ID, there's a... And again, I must emphasize that we do not have the source documents. The source documents reside with ESCOM as the employer. We've agreed that this is the information that ESCOM needs to provide to us. So when we are checking, we're checking for accuracy, and we're checking that the information that we expect to be there is there. You know, I also want to just highlight the fact that, you know, as a fund, we expect that ESCOM knows the rules. You know, there's reasons why we would expect ESCOM to know the rules, because we have regular updates with ESCOM where we interact through with various stakeholders through various interactions. We do presentations to ESCOM. We also have got what is called a member guideline that summarizes the rules that ESCOM is well aware of. Everyone at ESCOM has got access to that information. When the fund goes through rule amendments, we actually, before we submit the rules to the FSB for approval, we submit those rules to ESCOM and give ESCOM those rules and say this is what we are proposing to change, and ESCOM has got an obligation as well, as there may be a potential impact in terms of what we are proposing as a fund to amend. And also, historically, ESCOM has also requested information from the fund relevant to calculations under various rules, and they've also applied various rules in the past, so which then makes us know that they actually know the rules. ESCOM has also got what we call an ESCOM pensions office, which is resourced by ESCOM individuals. This office acts as a liaison between ESCOM and the fund. And I did allude earlier on that around about 2012, 2013, we had extensive discussions with ESCOM in terms of making sure that they understand what it is that they're supposed to incorporate in the file. And also ESCOM themselves have issued various, you know, internal memos and documents to their own staff members, articulating the rules, that these are the rules of the pension fund, this is how you exit a pension fund. So we are very comfortable as a fund that ESCOM knows the rules, they know how the rules should be applied, and you know, we rely on them to make sure that the rules are applied, because they've got the source documentation which we as a fund unfortunately do not have. So I think I've taken you through as well the process that we onboard a new member in terms of the various files and the various forms that we then rely on. And also when we exit a member as well, we also do the same, where we place reliance on ESCOM to make sure that the information that ESCOM provides is actually correct and accurate for the reason that the member is exiting the fund. In terms of the forms that the fund has that are applicable, the forms have got you know, various rules that you have to tick that this is the reason why the member is exiting. Also, the member has to sign on a particular form to confirm that that is correct, as well as ESCOM as the employer, when we get an exit form, they have to sign that this form has been reviewed and is correct and the applicable rule has been applied. And this has been consistent with what has happened in the past. I think there was a question as well or a comment that came around what are the available rules that can exit a member. There is various rules that a member can exit through. You know, we've got Rule 18, Rule 23, Rule 24, Rule 25, and Rule 28. Those are various forms under which a member can be exited from the fund. As part of our submission, we have included the fund rules So if reference is required, we can then go to the fund rules and make reference in terms of what each of those rules entail. I just want to focus a little bit on one particular rule out of the rules that I've mentioned. And again, I just want to explain the principle around the rule. When we again get to the Molefe specific circumstance, we will then come back to the rule, but at least you will then have context. I want to focus on Rule 28. Rule 28, before Rule 28, there's a heading in the rules that says retrenchment. I think this issue was much subject of media attention that Rule 28 had been utilized, but the heading says retrenchment. If the heading does say retrenchment, but if you look at the rules itself and the substance of the rule, really this is a rule that deals with the retirement of a member who has not reached the age of 65. It then has got certain conditions that need to be satisfied for this rule to be applied. It says that you know, a member who has not reached the age of 65 can be retired from service owing to a reduction in or reorganization of staff, or to the abolition of his office or post, or in order to facilitate improvements in efficiency or organization, or to retrenchment generally. I think we need to just note that because we will come back to that rule when we deal with the issue of Mr. Molefe. Then the rule has got subsections. It's got subsection 1 up to 4. When we deal with the Molefe issue, we will focus on the rule itself, and we will focus more closely on subsection 3. Subsection 3 of the rule deals with the issue of a member who has attained the age of 50. Again, we will then come back to that. It also goes on to say a member who's attained the age of 50 or who had attained the age of 45 years and who is listed, there's a particular appendix that was attached to the rules, and has not less than 10 years pensionable service, becomes entitled to a benefit in terms of this rule. I think it's important that we just note that rule because, again, when we deal with the Molefe issue, we will come back to that rule. So that is generally how the fund itself operates, and that is the issue, I think, still on Rule 28. There is the issue that when you read Rule 28, it goes on further to talk about the issue of the discretion that needs to be applied by the employer, that at the discretion of the board. Again, we will cover that issue more in more detail when we get to the Molefe issue. So there's also another rule that I want to touch on, which again I'll come back to later. This is Rule 21-4. Rule 21-4 specifically deals with the ability of the employer to be able to purchase additional service for an employee. I think we need to just note the rule again. And note that it's not unusual for an employer, especially in a defined benefit fund, to be permitted to purchase additional service, because again, this will become relevant when we deal with the issue of Molefe. And again, maybe for purposes of record, that rule reads that an employer may make a special payment to the fund in order to add to the pensionable service of a member in his employ such period of past service as the board, after consulting the actuary, determine. So I think it's also important just to deal with that. It's important also to note that over the years, Eskom has applied these rules, you know, to a number of its employees. It has purchased additional service for other employees before, and it has retired other employees using Rule 28, which will be the subject of the discussion. I also want to highlight that the fund has got regular interactions with the employees as well, as a fund, we have a responsibility that we need to engage with our employees, inform them of, especially those that are new to the fund. Even those that are not new to the fund, you find that issues of pension fund are issues that they are not dealing with on a day-to-day. And some issues around the pension fund are complex issues, so we do engage with our members on a regular basis. When it comes to executive ESCOM employees, what we do, we actually go a step further where we can even have what we call a more personal and intimate service to those members, where we go and sit with them on a one-on-one. Given the number of ESCOM employees, it will be difficult to do that for all 46,000 employees. So we would generally make presentations on a wider audience. Some of the presentations are initiated by the fund, but we do have instances where, you know, a small group of members come, call the fund and say, we are sitting somewhere in Cape Town. We would like the fund to come and address us because there is this issue that we do not understand. And then the fund, as part of its member communication initiatives, does accede to those requests. I hope that gives a good indication in terms of the background of the fund, in terms of how the fund operates, and also I've drawn attention to some of the rules that would rules of focus as we move forward. I would like now to move specifically to the issue of Mr. Molefe.
Just before you get there, can you just take the committee through the different forms of exiting the fund, your fund?
Okay. In order to exit the fund, you can exit the fund in various ways. You can resign from the employer, whereby you then choose that you want to take your benefit. You can either transfer it to another fund or a preservation fund, or you can withdraw it and take it as cash. That is one form of withdrawal. If you want to take it as cash or if you want to withdraw it, we do a calculation where we compare what is called an MIR, Member Individual Reserve, and that will tell us whether your investment, you know, using actuarial factors, what's the value of that investment vis-a-vis your contributions plus interest up to that point. Then the higher of the two amounts is what you would then take out. You can die, be deceased, to exit the fund as an active member. If you die, there's again a rule that deals with debts. In terms of the Act, there is also what is called Section 37C, where then the board has to then allocate your benefit. We calculate the benefit based on twice your pensionable salary, and that gets distributed to your beneficiaries. We then also calculate a spousal pension that we then pay to your spouse. If you have children that are under the age of 21, then there is also a pension for those children up till the age they get to age 21. You can retire normally from the fund. You either, if you are 50 years, we can use Rule 28. The employer has to agree to that. It's initiated by the employer, not the fund. Or if you are age 55, you can retire on your own. You don't need permission from your employer. But there would be penalties that would be applicable, which will then reduce your benefit. Or you can get to age 63. When you get to age 63, the penalties are no longer applicable. You can retire. Then the forced retirement age is age 65. So once you get to 65, you then have to retire from the fund. You cannot continue being an active contributing member. There is also ill health benefit. Generally, other funds insure ill health outside. Given the size of the fund, we are self-insured for ill health benefit. So if you are unfit for duty, there is a process that we go through where you are assessed medically and then you are medically boarded. The fund has got a benefit which we call an ill health benefit that you will then be entitled to, which will exit you from the fund. So those are the means and forms of exiting the fund.
We can then get to where you wanted to get us.
Okay. I'll start with at the inception, when Mr. Molefe was appointed at Eskom. I think it is common knowledge that Mr. Molefe had worked at Transnet before he then went to Eskom and acted at Eskom for a period of, for a number of months, and then was appointed to Eskom as the group chief executive of Eskom. So according to our records as the fund, we have Mr. Molefe having joined the fund on the 14th of September 2015. I think it's, I'm mentioning that date because you will note that as we move along, there are some discrepancies in terms of the dates. We had never had sight of his employment contract, but later on, when there were court cases that were ongoing, it's only then that we had sight of his employment contract. I will come back to the case, court case and how it affects the fund. At that point, I think we then realized that actually the effective employment date that was cited on the employment contract was 1 October, which is different from the 14th October. When Mr. Molefe exited the fund, he signed his forms and recorded his exit date as 25 September. So there's three dates now in terms of when he's... He cited his employment date as 25 September. So the fund, according to his record, I think I explained earlier on that the fund receives information from Eskom. It received the LEC file, which contained information, and in that LEC file, it highlighted 14 September. We then received contributions for September. So we then tied that date to the contributions that we received. When he exited, when he signed his form, he said his employment date was 25 September. His contract cited 1 October. Maybe let me deal with the issue of exiting him, then I'll come back and tell a chronological story, because when we exited him, we had to now decide which date. At the time, we had two dates. We didn't know about the 1 October. We knew 14 September and 25 September. Given that the fund had received money dating back to 14 September, we then used that as our date of his employment or his membership to the fund. Looking at the difference between 14 September and 25 September, from a financial point of view, given that we had received payment for those days, it was negligible and nothing turned out of that for the fund. So the fund utilized the first date. So I think this is just the first issue, because as in the documentation that we've submitted, these dates do come up. So I think it's important that we just deal with them upfront. There was this variance. So again, when Mr. Molefe was became a member of the fund, we received the LEC file. I've explained in terms of the information on the LEC file, and one important thing that was on the LEC file, which is the file that contains membership data, was a code. This code says PPX. And in our agreement with the ESCOM, according to us, PPX means that you are permanent and you are an executive at an F-band level at ESCOM. So when we didn't, when he first came in September and we did our recons, we checked that to say, is he permanent? He's on permanent, fixed term, he's an executive. So we can tick the box to say that we've satisfied ourselves that what ESCOM is giving us, they are confirming that this member is an eligible member, because the issue of permanent and non-permanency talks to eligibility. So that was done. And then Molefe became a member of the fund and contributed on a monthly basis from there on. I think the first month there was a bit of a delay in terms of his contribution, and because we had received the LEC file, but his name was not on, I think, the pay file. We then inquired to say, you know, there's a discrepancy here. They then, I think, processed immediately payment for their contribution for that month, and then going forward, they then added his name in the normal pay file that we received, and we continue to receive contributions from Mr. Molefe from that point on until the point that he exited as a member. What happened just before he was onboarded as a member, I did highlight that in terms of executives, when we onboard executives, we do offer a VIP treatment to those executives where we go and sit down with them. Again, in this instance, we then received a request from a specific Mr. Anton Minar. Anton Minar is an employee of Eskom. I believe that he is the general manager, HR remuneration at Eskom. Our understanding as the fund is that he is the one who deals with remuneration, pension fund issues for executives at Eskom. He then contacted the fund and contacted particularly Mr. Solin Zibande from the fund. Mr. Zibande is the client liaison manager of the fund, so he would be the one that would be expected to go and engage with executives at Eskom and advise them about the pension fund and how the pension fund works. So this took place, and there was a meeting that was held. I think the first meeting was held on the 29th of September, 2015, where Mr. Zibande went to meet with Mr. Molefe. In meeting with Mr. Molefe, Mr. Minar was present as well at that meeting. And the subject of discussion was that Mr. Molefe wanted to understand that he had pension benefits at Transnet that he wanted to bring over to the fund. So he wanted to understand how that would work and whether the fund could accommodate taking over those benefits that he had at Eskom. There was a discussion around that. He was informed that in terms of the rules of the fund is actually able to untake those benefits. We then categorize those benefits as additional voluntary benefits. They become additional. They do not form part of your basic pension that you would contribute to the fund. The rules allow for that. And there's various other members in the fund that have brought in their benefits. Or what you can do as well is, I did allude earlier on to the fact that there's a calculation that is used where there is a 7.3% plus 20.5%. If a member chooses to also contribute more, they can contribute. The rules allow for that. And again, that does not form part of your basic pension, but it goes into what we call an additional voluntary scheme. So he was advised that this could happen. Then he was advised that he would have to inform Transnet Pension Fund. Transnet would have to go through particular steps up to a point where they would have to apply for a tax directive, and then once that was approved, they would come to the fund with something that's called an ROT. An ROT is short for what we call a recognition of transfer, which then means that the fund can then accept those funds from Eskom. This benefit was in the region of about 4.2 million that he wanted to transfer from Eskom, from Transnet to Eskom. That process unfolded, and I think Transnet went through. I can't speak for Transnet, but we then eventually got the correct documentation, and the money was transferred over to the fund. Then there was various other meetings that were requested by Mr. Anton Minar. I would probably just try and, go through some of the meetings and very high-level highlight what would have been the discussion. So I think around about November, there was, again, another... some of these were emails. In our submissions, we have attached all of the correspondence. Some of these were meetings. So there was various correspondence where Mr. Minar, I think as early as November 2015, was requesting the fund to do calculations in respect of Molefe's overall pension payments and any early retirement costs in the event that Mr. Molefe were to retire 5 years later when he was age 54, and what would be the cost implications if the penalties were waived. We calculated those benefits. At different days and different times, there were these requests that came through via email to say, now calculate what happens from the age of 55, what happens at the age of 63. And all of this took place around about November 2015, where we then calculated, did various calculations. And I think in one of the emails, that was sent to us, we were put under pressure as a fund to say, you know, we need this information urgently because it was saying that calculate these numbers as the information is required to finalize the issue with the minister. So we don't know what minister they were referring to because it didn't say what minister, but it just said we need this information to finalize the issue with the minister. And again, as the fund, you know, we provide a service to the employer. We did the various calculations and send those calculations over to ESCOM. Then Molefe became a member. There were no further interactions. He then contributed all the way until about August 2016. I think on the 18th of August 2016, we received again a request from Minar, Anton Minar at ESCOM, now requiring the fund to do early calculation for early retirement costs if Molefe were to be retired at the age of 50. With penalties being waived and additional years of service being bought up to the age of 63. Again, the fund calculated those benefits and then gave the information back to Mr. Minar. I think he then, at the time, the cost of the benefit, I think we had calculated it in August to be around 25.9 million, that if he were to be retired at age 50 and they were to buy him additional service up to age 63, what would be the cost? It was around 25.9 million at the time, which is different from what actually the 30 million eventually that the cost of this benefit became at the end. The difference is really as a result of the fact that there are certain variables that at the time we did not have. For example, number one, this calculation is based on the actual, on the cost. So at that time when we did the calculation, I think his salary had not been adjusted upwards. Also, when we do the assumption, we have to factor in the issue of a spouse. We make assumptions that the spouse will be about 5 years younger than the member. So if the spouse turns out to be much younger, that also affects the cost of the benefit. So when we did the initial cost at 25 million, those two issues in the main, we had made assumptions, used the existing salary, as well as a spouse who is 5 years younger. When the final calculation was actually done, we now had actual numbers where the salary had increased, as well as I think Mr. Molefe had married a spouse at that point in time, who was much younger than the 5 years. So there was a much bigger gap between the 5 years we had used as an estimation as well as the actual. Yeah.
He was aware of the rules. So.
Madam Chair, I think, as I indicated earlier on, that it is our expectation that ESCOM knows the rules. ESCOM have applied these rules on numerous occasions. So we then so there was that exchange. We then gave the numbers to them, and then later on, I think this was now in sometime in November. Again, we kept on getting requests to do different calculations, and around about December, I think early December, we then received a request for a meeting again from ESCOM, and I think in this instance now, the meeting, I think it was about the 19th of December. The meeting was now requesting for the collection of documents. at Eskom. So again, Mr. Nsibande went to Eskom and met with, I think, a Ms. Merinda Porta, who works in Anton Minar's office, and collected documents. Now, these were the documents that were dealing now with the exit of Mr. Molefe. In the documents that were collected, there was a firstly a letter. Okay, maybe let me start with the form. There was a form that had been completed by both Mr. Molefe as well as Eskom itself. And in this form, they ticked the relevant boxes to say we are retired. Mr. Molefe is being retired using early retirement. Then that was accompanied by a letter. This letter was signed by the then Dr. Ben Ngubane, who was the then chairperson at the time. And the letter was very clear that, you know, Mr. Molefe, your application for early retirement has been approved, and we are invoking Rule 28 as well as Rule 21-4. So there was no ambiguity in terms of which rules Eskom wanted the fund to apply in terms of Rule 28 and Rule 21-4. And then it further stated that any penalties would be waived. It further stated that they would, you know, purchase additional service for Mr. Molefe of 13 years, which then took him to age 63 because he was turning age 50 in December. So it was very clear from the fund that, you know, Eskom understands the rules. This is what they've given us. Ours is to test that, you know, if they say Rule 28, is it 50 years? Are they going to pay additional costs? You know, we have to recover those additional costs and everything according to the fund, you know, had been ticked. So when the fund received this information, you know, it went through the normal processes. I had explained earlier on that we've got, you know, various delegations. Normal processing is something that myself, you know, I would not generally have sight of because there's processes that, you know, had been agreed that this is how the delegation works. You know, I'll deal with the issue of when I first became aware of the issue. I think the first time I became aware of it was around probably I think it was about August or September when they were now saying we must calculate. This was in 2016. As part of normal discussions with my team, I think the issue did come up that Eskom had asked the fund to calculate these benefits for Mr. Molefe. There may be a possible exit of Mr. Molefe. And I noted the issue, you know, and, you know, the discussion was along the lines that it must just be done in terms of the rules. And then I never heard about the issue until much later. So when we got the claims forms, the claim forms were processed in the normal manner where they went through the processing department. The processing department, as part of Rule 28, have to check the age. Age 50, yes, Mr. Molefe will be age 50, effective 1 January, which was the date that he was going to go on retirement. He was going on 31 December, but was going to become a member on 1 January 2017. He had met that. The employer had actually submitted a letter, which then confirms that they had applied Rule 28. Again, we satisfied ourselves that Rule 28 is applicable. He did not have the 10-year required service, and this is where the employer invoked Rule 21-4, which Rule 21-4 enables the employer to actually buy additional service. He then also, the employer was very clear that the penalties must be waived, and they will foot the bill, take up the cost for those penalties. So it then got processed. It went through the normal delegations. It was signed off. Checked the calculations, we applied for a tax directive. Mr. Molefe opted to take one-third of his benefit in cash and left two-thirds to buy him a monthly pension that he would then earn until end of his life. And then the spouse will assume pension as well. That's why it's important for the fund to understand the age of the spouse, because if the member is no more, then the spouse, in terms of the rules, then assumes the pension. So that affects the cost if the spouse is much younger. So this was then processed accordingly. Come 1 January, Mr. Molefe became a pension of the fund. He was exited. I think in terms of paying his benefits, there was a bit of a delay because it was firstly the January season where things were closed. But then we applied for a tax directive. We received a tax directive. And if I'm correct, I believe around about February sometime is that we were able to pay him his pensions from 1 January 2017. And then at some point as well, around about February, we paid him his one debt less the tax. And then he was on our payroll and started receiving pension on a monthly basis. Until the point where when we received correspondence from ESCOM that we should suspend paying his pension. But I'll deal with that in a chronological manner.
Sorry, Mr. Lutuli, and you'll be specific on how much did he get after you were given out in your chronological manner.
I can deal with that. Yeah. Let me deal with how the 30.1 million was calculated. It is quite a complex calculation, but I'll try. In the documents that we've submitted, we've put details. But I'll try and simplify it to the best that I can. So what ESCOM had said we must do is that we must actually calculate, they would buy him additional service, they would waive penalties. So to do that, you then have to take his last salary that he was earning, he was earning around about 5.6 million rands as a salary. On that, you then have to add the additional months to take him to age 63. Which in this instance is about 156 months that you have to add. So you then get, so he had worked 16 months plus 100, and he had worked 16 months plus 156 months, you have 172 months. You then have to calculate the penalties using Rule 24 on his actual benefit, which is he has worked for 16 months, he earned 5.6 million. If he were to retire now, what would be the penalties that would apply, and there's an amount. Then you have to deduct the two amounts, the grossed up amount which has been grossed up to age 63 from this amount. And the difference between the two is an actuarial calculation of 30.1 million.
Can you repeat that?
You want to ask something? You can ask if you want to get into what he has just said.
No, Chair. Okay. I think.
There's a request that he repeats it, but slowly.
So. Let me try and do it slowly. I think that you had asked earlier on why we have an entourage of people there, people that do the actual calculation that we've brought, that if my explanation is still not proper English, we can request them to Englishize it. You take his last...
We do not want English. We want to understand the calculations, the amounts, how did they get to that amount. The English part of it, we do not want it. We want just the understanding of the amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you take his last salary. He was earning 5.6 million. To that, you then add the number of... He was earning 5.6 million. He had worked for 16 months. So that is the first part of the calculation. I think it's important that you get an answer to that he was earning 5.6 times the number of months, then you bank that. No, 5.6 million rands per annum. Yeah. You then do a secondary calculation, which then says the employer wants to take him to age 63. So to take him to age 63 when he's 50, you need to add more months to then have a theoretical service that he did not have, which is going to cost money. So you then cross this up, the number of months, to get to 172 months, to say the total number of months that he would have worked. So he worked 16 plus 156 months, which is what you are purchasing theoretically. You then get to an answer of 172 months. You then look at the difference between the two to say, this is the cost, this is the actual that he's worked. There is an amount. This is the theoretical that they've bought him. What is the difference between the two? You then have to factor his spouse into the calculation as well. As I indicated that if there is a spouse, we assume the spouse is 5 years younger. If the spouse is more than 5 years younger, the cost of that benefit goes up. So in this instance, the spouse was more than 5 years. We had to use the actual number of years that the spouse was. We shot up the benefit, the cost of that benefit. So that's how you then get to the 30.1. You know, I'm trying to simplify it as I can. There's a detailed calculation that we've included as part of the submission, but I'm just trying to make it as simple as it can be. Yeah.
Okay. We must be fair to the individuals or individual concerned. At this stage, my understanding is that he is, Mr. Molefe is not involved personally in this transaction. That this is an interaction taking place between Eskom, represented by the board, and the pension fund. Is that correct?
Yeah. At this point, when these were calculated, the process is triggered by Eskom as the employer. You know, firstly, Eskom asked us, do these calculations. When we did them, we used assumptions. We used the actual salary of I think it was slightly less than 5.6 at the time. I think in between that, he got a salary increase, which then when we had to do the actual calculation, we had to use that. But this was triggered now to do the actual calculation. It was triggered by a letter that came from Eskom. So from the fund's point of view, we don't know what decisions or what informed the approvals from Eskom. All we received was a letter, and then we followed a process in terms of, is it 50 years? You know, has the employer confirmed that these are the rules that they want? So this means that we must then do this calculation. And the letter was clear. It said apply Rule 28 and apply Rule 21-4. Rule 21-4 is important because the Rule 28 specifies that you must have at least 10 years service. So if you don't have the 10-year service, you can't qualify for Rule 28. To then overcome that, you must apply Rule 21-4, which Rule 21-4 then bought him 13 years additional service. So he then could meet Rule 28 because he now had more than 10 years additional service that they had bought him.
Okay, but the question that I'm asking is that the letter that bought Mr. Molefe, in this instance, is a subject matter, but he is not the one writing to the fund saying, I'm buying for myself 156 months. That letter comes from Dr. Ngubane.
That is correct. The letter came from Dr. Ngubane. It was signed by Dr. Ngubane.
Can we then move to the subsequent developments?
Yeah. I've concluded the first part of the calculation. I think I need to move to the second part before I proceed. So once we've established the cost of the benefit, to retire him, we then do a separate calculation Now we've said to retire him, it's going to cost this much. Eskom, you must pay us this 30.1 million, which Eskom did pay to the fund. They didn't pay to Molefe because I think later on when the media reports came, it was purported as if the money was paid to Molefe. It was never paid to Molefe. It was paid to the fund to actually cover the cost that the fund had calculated to say, if you want us to do this, we are a DB fund. We cannot prejudice other members, so you must pay this amount. They then, you know, paid it. We then did a separate calculation. In this calculation, now we are calculating his pension. So we then took his 5.6 million. We then added the 172 months to that. We multiplied by 172 months because they've bought him now the 172. So now they've bought him the additional 156. So he now has that. You then multiply it by a factor, which is a factor that's actually calculated of 2.17%. That then gives you a gross amount of his pension benefit. So his pension benefit was, his statutory pension was around about 29 million was the amount. He then opted to take a third of that amount as a cash lump sum. We then calculated a third, 29 million plus, divided by 3, a third is about 7.9 million. That 7.9 million was paid to him, subject tax. Tax had to, we applied for a tax directive, they deducted tax, and we paid the balance to him after tax. I think you must recall that earlier on I had mentioned that he had brought in money from Transnet. He had brought in about 4.2 million. Again, he opted, when we retired, again, he's entitled to take a third of that amount. So we took the 4.2 million and we added interest to it. With interest, it was at that point in time around about 5.2 million. Again, we took a third of that, which was about 1.7 million. Again, we applied for a tax directive. The receiver then issued a tax directive. So he got a combination amount of, the 7.9 plus the 1.7, which was around about 9.7 million, less tax. I think the amount that he actually took out in cash after tax was about 7.9 million, if I'm not mistaken. I'll come back to that because at some later stage, again, there were tax issues that arose. Then the two-thirds that he left behind at the fund bought him a monthly pension. So he had a monthly pension from the statutory amount, which was around about 95,000. He then also had an additional pension of about 15,000. If you add those two amounts, so his gross pension was about 111,000 that we paid him on a monthly basis until... Yes. I hope I'm...
Can you may proceed?
Okay. So I think maybe I should start when... So now he's a pensioner. We've paid him this amount. So we paid all these amounts towards the end of February. So once we've calculated all these amounts, I think you must recall that we had been working with estimates. So now we had actual numbers. So we paid the amounts and then we calculated the actual numbers. We then went to Eskom and said, Eskom, you owe us 30.1 million. Can you please pay the 30.1 million? We invoiced them. They paid over the 30.1 million to the fund. I think it was on the 23rd of March 2017. So this money hit the fund's bank account. And from the fund's point of view, we've covered our cost, we've done the calculations, and we've recovered the money, so no member is prejudiced. Around about April, I think it was on the 19th of April, if I'm not mistaken, it was a Sunday, there was a newspaper article it was not the 19th. It was actually the 16th. Sunday was the 16th. There was a newspaper article in the Sunday Times. And in this newspaper article, it then said that, there was this amount that had been paid to Molefe of 30.1 million. So when I read this, I actually got very concerned because I was, where is this 30.1 million coming from? I recall that I had had a discussion around 26 million. So the first thing I did is I actually phoned Joey Sanka, who is the manager responsible for operations, and I said, look, I'm reading the Sunday Times here, and there is two things that are of concern to me. One, I hear there's a 30 million that was paid, a pension that was paid to Mr. Molefe. Can you first confirm that the pension fund has never paid 30 million to Mr. Molefe, which he confirmed. He then took me through what had transpired to say, you recall I had mentioned a figure of 25, 26 million. When we did the actual calculation, we had to factor in the actual salary, we had to factor in the actual spouse. So the number moved from the 25, 26 million to 30.1 million. So the 30.1 million that's reported is factually correct, but this is money that was actually paid into the fund, not paid to Molefe, and we had done all these calculations, and we had retired Molefe, and he was earning a pension, and this is the amount of money that he had taken as a debt. I was then satisfied with that. I then followed that up by phoning the chairperson of the board to alert the chairperson, because I was concerned that now there may be reputational issues for the fund, with the pension fund being mentioned in the media. Again, indicated to the chairperson that there is this article in the paper, in the Sunday Times. Let me correct the facts. I corrected the facts with the chairperson that the 30.1 million was actually paid into the fund. This transaction had gone through the normal processes of the fund. The chairperson asked why this not been raised with the board. I explained that, chairperson, there is the delegations that are in place which delegate management to deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis. So that is why it had been dealt with on the day-to-day basis and had never been escalated to the board. I think after that, I later that day spoke to the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee of the fund again, alerting him to the issue that there was this issue that had been mentioned in the newspaper article, and again corrected the facts with him, and again spoke about the issue of delegation, that this issue had been delegated to management, hence it had not been necessary to find its way to the board. Even myself, it was not necessary for me to sign it off as the chief executive because there were proper delegations that were in place. Then a few days later, we then had on the 20th of April, Mr. Nzibande from the fund got a call from Mr. Minar for a meeting, an agent meeting that Mr. Minar wanted to have with Mr. Nzibande. Then they had this meeting. Mr. Nzibande attended this meeting. After the meeting, he actually wrote an email to myself and to Joey. Mr. Nzibande reports to Mr. Sanka, expressing concern that he had been called into a meeting whereby he believed that he was meeting with Anton Minar. But when he arrived at the meeting, there were two other people at that meeting, and I think the meeting was somewhere in Midrand, not in the Eskom offices. He said that there was a Mr. Adil Patel who had indicated that he was from Cliff Decker Hofmeyr, and there was a Miss Veneta Klein from Eskom who indicated that she was the chairperson of the People and Governance Committee at Eskom, and he was familiar with her because I had been present as well when we had done a presentation to the same committee some months earlier. And his concern was that he had attended the meeting, understanding that he was meeting Anton Minar, and then there were these other individuals. So he got very concerned. So he then explained that he was asked around the correctness of the calculation of the 30.1 million, which he reconfirmed that the fund had done this calculation correctly. He was asked as to whether, the fund was comfortable that these amounts were proper and corrected. And I think, again, we've attached all those correspondence and all that detail into our submission. Then there were various other things and correspondence that happened from that point on between ESCOM and the fund, where we then got emails from ESCOM requesting the fund to meet with, I think the first one was to meet with Sizwe and Zaluba Koboto, who were auditors appointed by ESCOM. And the purpose of that meeting was that these auditors wanted to recalculate this 30.1 million because I think at that point now, they were trying to question the fund as to correctness of the 30.1 million. And the fund took them through the calculation, and our belief, because they never came back to the fund, was that they were satisfied that the calculation was correct. Subsequent to that, we also got another request from ESCOM now to meet with Ernst & Young, EY. And I was myself present at that meeting, and really the purpose of that was EY was investigating who had leaked this information to the media. They wanted to establish from the fund whether the leak to the media was from the fund. And again, we participated in that, and we explained to them the processes that the fund follows. And I think when they left the meeting, they were satisfied that the fund had nothing to do with leaking information, because what was being cited in the media was reports from an SAP system, which the fund does not use. So ESCOM is the one that uses an SAP system. This was purportedly the documentation that had been leaked to the media about the payment of this 30.1 million. So when they left there, they were satisfied that the fund had not, it could not, these leaks could never have come from the fund. Around about the 8th of May, we received all of this correspondence and these requests. On the 12th of May, I received a letter addressed to me from Ms. Susan Daniels in an email requesting the fund to stop paying Mr. Molefe's pension. I think this was on the 12th of May, to which later on we then responded to ESCOM asking to understand on which basis are they saying we must stop the pension payment, because in terms of the rules you can't start and stop a pension. There are legal implications for us as a fund if we just suspend pension without understanding the reason why we would be suspending that pension. And then there were various other correspondence as well, where then subsequently I think Mr. Molefe was reinstated at ESCOM. Again, we then got a letter telling us that he had been re-employed at ESCOM, and then indicating that the period that he had left up to the period of re-employment would be taken as unpaid leave, and then we must stop paying the pension. We then confirmed that we had suspended the pension at this point, but then asked ESCOM to clarify to the fund what is the position of Mr. Molefe, so that we can look at our rules and see whether, how to treat this issue, because we had never had a situation like this, similar to this Mr. Molefe issue. So whilst all of this was happening on the site, from a governance point of view on the fund, the first article had been in the media on the 16th of April. Then came the 19th of April, we had a board committee meeting, a benefits committee of the board. And at this meeting, this was the first time that the issue then came up immediately after it had been in the media. And again, at this meeting, the board committee asked management to explain what had transpired around this issue. And management explained that these are the circumstances, this is what had transpired, and presented all the facts. I think then later on there was another meeting as well of the investment committee of the board, and again similar questions were asked by the board committee, and again management explained what had transpired. Then on the 16th of May, we had the fund has got a legal and governance committee of the board. Again, we had a meeting at this committee. Now at this committee, we did a presentation to this committee dealing with onboarding Mr. Molefe, you know, and all the issues and correspondence, and also how we got to pay the benefit. Then explained that as far as management was concerned, this had followed all the rules and there were delegations that were in place. It was at this committee that the board committee requested that we seek independent legal advice to just make sure that from a fund's point of view, we followed all the processes and the rules accordingly that we were supposed to have followed. We immediately after that meeting instructed our legal advisors, Norton Rose, to then formulate, look through what the fund had done, look through whether, because there were now media reports that were questioning the applicability of Rule 28, whether Rule 28 was applicable or not. This was, I think, around about the 16th of May when we then requested Norton Rose to do this. Then the board decided to have a special board meeting so that this the board of the fund had a special board meeting where now the attorneys of the fund could come and present their opinion in terms of whether the correct rules had been applicable or not. This was done again in May. And I think the legal advice or the legal opinion that the fund received was that actually Rule 28.1 relt with Rule 28.3 qualified Molefe to be retired from the fund. So the fund had correctly retired Mr. Molefe in terms of those rules, and also looking at Rule 21.4, which permitted the employer to buy additional service. So in as far as that was concerned, the fund had acted correctly. What they then raised was, if you read Rule 28, especially Rule 28.3, it does indicate that this should be done at the discretion of the board. So they then indicated that this should have actually been presented to the pension fund board to apply its discretion. So by virtue of it not having been presented to the pension fund board, it then meant that this retirement was actually ultra virus. Those were the words that were used in the opinion. At that point in time, we had not dealt with the issue of delegation. So subsequent to that, we then presented the delegations that were in place to the attorneys to then consider them in light of what they had indicated. There was a specific delegation that had been long-standing where the board had delegated even issues of discretion to management. Again, they looked at that. When they came back, they said, yes, it's well and good that when you effected this transaction, you rightfully believed that this was delegated to management because here is a proper delegation from the board. But the board in the first place, you know, this was an old standing delegation, should have never delegated delegation to management. Discretion. You should have never delegated discretion to management. You can't delegate discretion. The discretion should have been exercised by the board. Then the next question was, can this transaction be undone? And the advice from the attorneys was that it can't be undone because it's already been done. To undo it, you would need a court order to actually undo the transaction. So in response to that, then the board immediately corrected the situation by saying that all issues that have to do with discretion in the rules that had been delegated to management must now from that point on be presented to the board. As there was a lot of media attention and we were getting a lot of media requests, there was concern to respond to those media requests because we still have confidentiality issues. Mr. Molefe was a member of the fund and we were in a difficult position as to, but how do we attend and address these media requests without breaching that confidentiality issue? But then the fund, you know, during the course of May, did release some media statements, I think particularly two media statements, where it was explaining that actually the fund had correctly applied the rules and had actually followed the rules, and Mr. Molefe qualified in terms of the rules to be retired using Rule 28. And also we then issued again communication to our members, again explaining what had happened, because also members were concerned that the fund was being financially disadvantaged because it had paid 30 million rands to Mr. Molefe, and again we assured them that that was not the case. Subsequent media reports also came out of interest. Two issues arose out of those media reports. The first issue that arose was an issue where the media was questioning the eligibility of Mr. Molefe, to say that, but Mr. Molefe was on a five-year fixed-term contract. So according to the rules of the fund, he should not have been a member of the fund in the first instance. When we then discovered this, we then sought legal advice. I think there were two issues. There was that issue, and secondly, the issue around tax, where, again, they were looking at the amount of tax that SARS, when they gave a tax directive, had deducted. We again sought legal advice on those two issues, and legal advice that came back indicated that actually, given the fact that there are eligibility rules which say that you must be permanently employed, if Mr. Molefe was on a five-year fixed-term contract, he should have never been a member of the pension fund in the first place. You know, and the fund, I think I had gone to length explaining that the fund relies on information that it received from ESCOM. In the past, all other CEOs, as far as the fund was concerned, had always been permanent employees. So even in this instance, when the ESCOM indicated that Molefe was a permanent employee, the fund had no reason not to trust the information that it had received from ESCOM. So now there was this issue that there's a legal opinion now saying that in the first instance, Mr. Molefe should have never been a member of the fund. We then followed again up on the issue of tax. When we had completed the application for tax for Mr. Molefe, in the tax form itself, there is a space where you have to tick and put a number if there's additional contributions that the member has made. I think you'll recall that there was an amount of 4.2 million that I had indicated earlier on, which had come from Transnet. So according to our rules, that amount was categorized as an additional voluntary contribution. So if you're applying for a tax directive for a member who does not have additional voluntary contribution, you do it electronically. But where a member has additional voluntary contribution, you must complete a manual form, send it to SARS. I suppose that SARS has to do their own checks to make sure that these amounts were taxed or not taxed before. So we then had done that. But what the advice, again, that we received was that if you look at the form, there was no other way where we could have disclosed the amount other than where we had disclosed it, and it was interpreted as if the amount had already been taxed before, whereas it turns out the amount was not taxed. So Mr. Molefe ended up getting a tax reduction in what he had then, what receiver deducted from the 4.2 million. Again, the advice went further to say when he completes his annual return, you know, these issues.
Can I ask something? No. If I wait, I'm going to miss all these amounts. I'm very interested in this amount. Can you rewind a little bit, especially on the amount he got from Transnet and the calculation of the tax?
Okay. Yeah. So when the amount came to the fund, according to the rules of the fund, it is categorized as an additional voluntary contribution. When you then submit for a tax directive to the SARS, you have, if a member has an additional voluntary contribution, you have to do a separate, a manual submission, which the fund did. It did a manual submission. In the box, in the form itself, there is somewhere where you need to complete where if there's any additional voluntary contribution. So the fund completed that form and indicated that there was this money which was categorized as an additional voluntary contribution. When SARS did the directive, they then did not deduct tax from that amount. So again, the fund sought advice, and I think we are in a process of engaging with SARS as well, so that going forward, we can then have clarity in terms of how to disclose these amounts going forward so that they are properly categorized. Parallel to all of this happening, then there was also a court case, or there is a court case that is ongoing. I think the court case is a court case that was instituted by Solidarity. The fund was cited, I think there's about 22 respondents. The fund was cited as one of the respondents. Initially, there was nothing really that was being asked from the fund because the issue was around Solidarity saying this whole reinstatement and these amounts must be reversed. What the fund then, based on legal advice, did was it filed an answering affidavit in that process, where at the time we had not dealt with the issue of eligibility. We were still under the view that Mr. Molefe had been eligible. We then filed an answering affidavit, and in this affidavit we then requested the court to decide on the matter, and if the court decided that the transaction must be reversed, we then indicated that the court need to also give an order that Molefe must pay back to the fund whatever amounts he had received. And we also asked the court to give an order because ESCOM had in one of their letters also requested that the fund must pay back the 30 million that they had paid to the fund, to which the fund indicated that in terms of the rules, there is no rule that allows the fund to actually pay back the money to ESCOM. So again, as part of the court action, we then requested that the court also gives an order that if this transaction is reversed, the fund can then pay back the monies to ESCOM, pay back the 30 million after recovering what had been paid to Molefe. Subsequent to that, the issue of eligibility then came along, and the fund was then advised legally that Molefe should not have been a member in the first instance. Then the fund filed a subsequent answering affidavit where it then indicated this position that the Molefe should have never been a member in the first instance in court papers, thus this whole transaction should be null and void. We also, as I indicated earlier on, that we do report to the FSB. We've proactively as a fund engaged with the FSB when these matters came to light and updated the FSB in terms of what had transpired. The FSB did ask for documents and evidence which we presented to the FSB. And we've kept the FSB up to date and informed in terms of the developments around this issue.
Okay.
Are you done? Is there anyone who wants to add something? No one. Can we take a 10-minute break? The information was too much and sometimes distressing. Can we just take... Is it 10 minutes too much? 5 minutes? Five minutes break. Thank you very much.
Right?
No.
Bonjour. Oh, Rubonga.
After everything.